Good morning. On the 7th of October, 1946, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you would have heard a man, Alan Ivamy, saying, posh voice required, "Welcome to our first Woman's Hour. It's your programme designed for you. There will be talks by experts on keeping house, on health, on children, furnishing, beauty care, in fact, on everything concerned with your sort of problems in the home." Yes, today is Woman's Hour's 70th birthday, and today we'll look back over some of those 70 years. By 1967, things had moved on a bit.
I think this next item is going to make some of you very angry, but these two young people have chosen deliberately to cohabit rather than marry, and they give their reasons. If their attitudes shock you, or even just irritate you, as they well may, it's perhaps worth remembering that today there are other young people, particularly in the big cities, who hold the same point of view.
Oh, shock horror. Now, as part of our birthday celebrations, Lauren Laverne has compiled a playlist of 70 songs by female artists to mark those 70 years. I'll be talking to Lisa Dwan, who's inherited Billy Whitelaw's crown as the finest interpreter of Samuel Beckett's work, and to Casa Pancho, who set up Ballyblack in 2001 because she found ethnic minorities were absent from classical. Now, when that first edition of Woman's Hour was broadcast 70 years ago today, two of the talks included Mother's Midday Meal and Putting Your Best Face Forward. So I guess it's hardly surprising that one of the newspaper reviewers described it as laughably domestic. Another, though, said the programme was dangerously radical. So what was it up to in those early years? Well, Sue McGregor was my predecessor. She presented the programme from 1972 to 1987. And Jean Seaton is Professor of Media History from the University of Westminster. They spoke to Jane to look back into the archive, beginning with Oranges and Lemons, the original theme tune. If the quality of their voices sounds slightly different from normal, maybe even better than normal, they were speaking into vintage microphones.
'46 is a very odd year, not least because I just worked out about a third of your listeners were pregnant, because in 1947 there was the first great surge of after-the-war births. Women who've been mobilised in Britain into the workforce. There was this terrible worry that, like after the First World War, somehow the men would come back and there'd be no jobs. So they tried to demobilise women very fast. There is still rationing. The war is over. But in fact, for the first time, you're dealing with bread rationing because, in fact, we were giving a lot of food to Germany. So the mood in 46 was a bit odd. And they come up with this programme, Woman's Hour, to try and mobilise all of that good women's listening, those women's issues. And it goes on to this new programme called the Light Programme. And it was intended for, hold your breaths, ladies, for the average woman, not of sophisticated taste.
The people who commissioned, I say people who commissioned, yeah. It was men who commissioned.
It was men who commissioned it, but it came out of programme makers, producers and editors, you know, the ground troops of the BBC, who were women trying to talk and knew how to talk with women, on women's side, not at women.
And, of course, Woman's Hour, as many listeners will know, was not presented by a woman when it first started.
The first presenter was a man called Alan Ivamy. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Well, he didn't last.
Well, he didn't last. Well, I mean, no Woman's Hour presenter lasts forever, Sue, as well.
No, but, I mean, he lasted about 3 weeks because all the women said, "Who's this man?"
We need to hear some of the... people will not believe this. It does illustrate how long we've been here. This is Woman's Hour in 1950, and I'm just going to play you a really short burst of a discussion about domesticity from the March of that year. This conversation is chaired by a lady called Evelyn Gibbs, and she is talking to some male contributors, actually.
Well, I'd like to ask all the husbands round the table whether they think it's a good idea to have more than one wife.
That depends entirely on the sort of wife you've got already.
W.P. Matthew.
If you've got a sort of specialist wife who's an awfully good cook and an awfully good housekeeper and who keeps the house perfectly fit and well and everything goes along and the goot honks high, but she's got a face like the back of a cab, and you're very fond of books, but she has no interest in literature or you're a great sportsman and she doesn't know one end of a tennis racket from another and calls it a tennis bat, then I think you've got a perfectly good case for having three other wives, one who's an awfully good looker, and one who's very interested in sport, and one who's a sort of blue stocking who knows all about literature. But if you've got a good all-rounder, well, make good, make do with her.
Barry.
Well, I think you can only have more than one wife if you have a very nice wife to begin with. And I think it's a very good thing, and she should have more than one husband, in the sense that she should have more people admiring her and sharing interests with her, and you should have more women. And you should both get, and I think can get, quite a lot of fun out of your mutual interests in that way.
Yes, things have changed a little bit since 1950. What did he said the back of a cab to describe
face
a woman's
face like the back of a cab. Well, I don't know about that. Handsome cab, maybe.
But yes.
There you are.
Well, I mean, from what you know, Jean, was that typical? And that was meant to be a light-hearted chat, I should say. It wasn't entirely serious.
But one is so flabbergasted, really, by that discussion. What is one person's light-hearted is somebody else's deeply offensive and irritating. So I thought that was a quite interesting example of the tone going wildly wrong right from the beginning. So, you know,
we've all been there.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not defending it. I'm just saying...
You have a good job. I mean, how on earth you do that?
No,
I know.
But it did break taboos. And I think that... I think it did that fairly consciously, really, from the beginning. I mean, I'm actually in a way rather interested in how consistent some of the themes you get in Woman's Hour.
Well, the gender pay gap featured in the first couple of weeks. Yeah. And unfortunately, 70 years on, we're still going on about it.
What really struck me about those voices, apart from Barry Bucknell, who sounded sort of rounded and mellow, was this very tight-collared, really cut-glass clipped.
Yes.
And that went on in the BBC. That was completely accepted. And when I first joined the BBC in the late 60s, I've come across some old recordings. I hope you haven't, Jane.
I sounded a bit
like that. And somehow, anyway, we now all, even the Queen's changed the way she speaks.
That's a wonderful and classic example of the way in which listening and broadcasting particularly finds what it is the voice of the day.
Well, Sue became the voice of today. That was a good link.
Yes, precisely.
She was the voice of Woman's Hour. And because I've been rereading your autobiography in preparation, I went on a little trip to the bottom of Broadcasting House's bottom.
What have you dredged up?
Well, I've tried to find your studio. Anyway, it didn't go well, but this is what happened.
I have never seen B9. The reason I'm looking for B9 is because I've got a much-thumbed copy of Sue McGregor's autobiography, Woman of Today, and she talks about her first ever edition of Woman's Hour, which she presented in September 1972, and it was from Studio B9, deep beneath the surface of Portland Place in the bowels of Broadcasting House. I had been warned not to be disturbed by odd noises. Apparently the Bakerloo line was close by. Well, here we are, and... Oh, Sue, this is depressing stuff. B9. I can't open it, and it's called Cage One. I always knew there was a special place where they put presenters they didn't want anymore. It appears to be a store cupboard, but Studio B9 no longer exists. And I certainly can't hear the Bakerloo line.
There I was. Quite intrepid for me, that, Sue.
That
and
was
in high
scary,
heels.
Jane.
Well,
very.
It is quite scary.
And yeah, it was in B9.
Yes,
when there
anybody,
was live cooking going.
Yeah,
on.
But we do live cooking occasionally now.
Including Mary Berry.
Yes, and she's very much a good chum of the programme, so we don't want to upset her. It's something that we still say about Woman's Hour. Oh, it's taboo busting. I think to a degree, I'm very proud of the fact that it still is. But back in the day, Jean, it was discussing the undiscussable.
Yes. I mean, if you look at the first 4 years, everybody being very polite, it did discuss. It had women and drink. Didn't call them alcoholics, but it looked at daytime drinking. It looked at social workers, very sort of pertinent. It looked at corporal punishment, whether it was a good or a bad thing. It began to talk about race relations. It had some Windrush people on.
These are not comfortable subjects,
but
are they?
But they're not.
No.
And they're not subjects that people are talking about in the 1950s, I don't think.
A couple of years into it, we get the first discussion of the menopause.
In the late 40s, which was a radical thing to do, the entire male top of the BBC burst a gasket.
Memos were flying back and forth.
Flying back and forth because somehow this was thought to breach propriety, decency, and they were all embarrassed. I imagine all the women were kind of turning it on and listening more loudly. So it's that relationship with your audience.
I think now the difference is, when I'm doing the programme, I sit in front of the screen and we looking at the tweets coming in. At the time, it was written, handwritten letters that would flood into the programme.
By 1947, it had established already what the BBC calls an appreciative and opinionated audience. And if you look at some of those letters, they're not unlike the letters that really people like Marjorie Proops, problem page people, they would say, and I've got this problem and you didn't mention it and I don't know what to do about it. So there was the development of an answering service.
And
which I'm really glad
you mentioned the relationship between the programme and the audience, which it still genuinely touches me that people are prepared to share so much with us, and they do without fail whenever we ask for their help. I think, Sue, you came in the early 70s.
What I remember about my very early days on Woman's Hour, actually it was a bit like what Jean said about problems shared and all that, it was a bit like a rather comfy club for women in the nicest sense. I just come from the rumbustious world of The World at One with William Hardcastle, live news and all that, and news and current events. And it was all very last minute and everything. And Woman's Hour was relatively a haven of peace and friendliness. There wasn't that much rivalry between people that you sort of get
in
news. It has. I know it's changed. Awful. And the two other things I remember very much. One was that the programme had its own drinks trolley, so that you could actually give people a glass of whiskey if they wished
before they went on air.
And there was one famous writer, Irish, I won't say who she was, who used to drink about half a bottle of gin before she went on air, and you would never have known. She was a wonderful storyteller. Mm. But the other thing I remembered on day one, and it was produced by a man, the token man, he used to call himself in Woman's Hour, was that everything was rehearsed first in the morning.
How did that work?
Well, not well, as far as I was concerned, because I thought, how can I interview somebody twice, you know? And
oh, so you would have the guests
even the
there.
Interviews were rehearsed. It was quite extraordinary. And there were a lot of talks, which were good, but, you know, this was the era of talks, the BBC, from pre-war right through to the, I suppose, the late 70s, people stopped doing it. But I said to the said male producer afterwards, do we really have to rehearse it, or can't we just kind of sit down and do it? And the look of relief that passed across his face.
I mean, and you did, of course, Margaret Thatcher was, I suppose, I mean, well, I'm not going to put...
She came into B9.
Right, did she?
Yes,
she found her way
to
B9.
Yes, and I remember she was very nice. She went round the back into the cubicle where the producer and the engineering staff were, and she introduced herself, Margaret Thatcher, in case they didn't know who she was. It struck me as... And then she said to me, because she wasn't comfortable on radio. And I remember when she sat down, this was before she was Prime Minister, she was Leader of the Opposition. And she said, do you think they'll be able to tell our voices apart?
You and Margaret Thatcher.
And I said, I didn't know what the required answer was to this, but I said, well, I expect, you know, once we start talking, they'll know who is you.
If I call you by your name, they'll probably spot that you're not me.
But she was nervous of radio.
Yes.
And, but, you know, when she came in as Prime Minister, then you couldn't get a word in edgeways.
Looking back, we did find in our Woman's Hour archive a letter called Is There a Future for Feminism? Now, this was written by a woman called Honor Croom. She was an economist. She became actually a regular contributor to the programme. And in 1947, she suggested that feminists effectively had won. They had got what they wanted. So we're going to hear an extract from that letter. Here it is, read by one of my esteemed colleagues.
But that's not to say that there isn't a future for feminism. Only it's got to be a different sort of feminism. Instead of occupying itself mostly with the opportunities, rights and grievances of the exceptional woman who wants to live as a man lives, it needs to pay some attention to the opportunities, rights and grievances of the ordinary woman. The grievances that follow from the bland assumption that mother doesn't matter. It's a very good thing that bricklayers shouldn't be overdriven, but it's mother who bears the brunt of the housing shortage. Even convicts rest on Sundays, even soldiers on active duty get leave. Not mother. Many a woman gets the only real rest of her married life when she's in bed with a new baby. Equality of the sexes, my eye. I'd like to see feminism turning its attention in that direction. It seems to me that women's rights would be pushed a whole lot further by a decent home help service than by opening the House of Lords to women or appointing one or two women ambassadors.
Now, Honor says some quite, well, to our ears, challenging things, but she also says stuff that actually a lot of people would relate to now. Anyone who's ever been, I was going to say marooned, and I think I will say marooned, with a newborn baby, there is no feeling like it, and you've never felt more alone in your life, actually.
I've seen that article written by Honor Croom, and I, like you, I was very impressed by how not much has changed. I mean, it seems almost to speak for our times as well.
Yeah.
But she seems to me also to be saying women at home should be, or they should receive some sort of wage, almost, wages for housewives, which yes. came in with a bang in the 70s. And I thought that it's still got all sorts of universal truths.
I think what's really interesting about some of the topics of Woman's Hour is that actually they have to be reinvented and they are indeed enduring. There is a wonderful quote from the 1970s that, and I think this is true, that says that Woman's Hour was a unique mixture of jam, Jerusalem, and genital warts.
that's a great description.
It did let it all hang out, one has to say. But it's also that sense of people who, well, I think that comes from the war, actually, of women as maintaining some reasonable decency in the face of all sorts of challenging circumstances.
There's a lot to be said for that. And listen, if you pick up the odd genital wart along the way.
Jean Seaton and Sue McGregor spoke to Jane on Monday in our celebratory programme. On Monday, we'll be announcing the results of the Woman's Hour 70th anniversary poll, looking at what life is like now for women in the UK. Moved on a bit, I think.